The Guardian.
Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, the suffragettes, Ed Miliband. The Labour leader's speech at the Trade Union Congress rally last weekend may be easily mocked, but could he cash in on a wave of anti-government sentiment? I'm Anne Perkins, and this is Politics Weekly. Coming up, we'll discuss the political impact of the anti-cuts march in London last Saturday. Plus, as Michael Gove embarks on a policy pirouette over the educational maintenance allowance, we'll take a closer look at the government's evolving schools policy. From division bells to wedding bells, union marches to bridal marches, we'll ask if marriage will make Ed Miliband more electable. And who is the most annoying person in modern politics? David Cameron makes his nomination. All that to come with our star lineup of Guardian columnists this week. In the studio, I have Julian Glover, Jackie Ashley, and Jonathan Friedland. Welcome to you all. As the clock struck two on Saturday afternoon, a small group of protesters broke away from the main demo in central London and began attacking Topshop on Oxford Street. At just about the same moment, as captured by news channels on a split TV screen, Ed Miliband took to the stage in Hyde Park to address the vast crowds at the TUC's March for the Alternative.
We come here today from all walks of life, from all classes, from all backgrounds, from all generations. And let me say to you, as I look across this historic park, at the sea of faces, it is a profoundly moving moment. We come in the tradition of those who have marched before us. The suffragettes who fought for votes for women and won. The civil rights movement in America, who fought for equality and won. The anti-apartheid movement, who fought the horror of that system and won. Our cause may be different, but we come together today to realize our voice, and we stand on their shoulders. We stand on the shoulders of those who have marched and struggled in the past.
Jackie Ashley, our cause may be different. Not in the same league, surely.
Somewhat very different. I think that was a most unfortunate comparison. I don't quite know what Ed Miliband was thinking in doing that. Yes, there was a lot of public feeling. There is a lot of public feeling about the cuts. But I think to compare that march with the suffragettes and the civil rights movement was just ridiculous, I'm afraid, and did his cause no good. And also, I think, sadly, focused attention on the fact that he'd been inappropriate, whereas I think, actually, his going to the march was a good thing. I'm not one of those who said he shouldn't have gone near it. I think he was unlucky that the violence kicked off just as he was speaking, and, as you said, the split-screen television screens did not look good. But I still don't think, you know, people can say, oh, he was responsible for the violence of the march. I think he took part in a decent and good demonstration, but I just think he went a little bit over the top with his rhetoric.
Were you there?
I went to the end of it. I wasn't there at the beginning.
Julian, do you think his message, the not no cuts but slower cuts, did that get out from underneath both the violence and his unfortunate parallels?
Well, I think the dishonesty is that he actually isn't opposed to all of the cuts he appeared to be marching against. So he's trying to have it both ways. And the danger for Ed Miliband, I think, isn't the short term of the media getting excited about demonstrations in one place and violence in another. And the polls this week haven't shown an implosion of Labour support. The dishonesty has a much more corrosive effect over the long term, which is beginning to be a feeling that Ed Miliband's trying to have it both ways. And he hasn't really decided whether he wants to be on the side of the groundswell of opposition to all cuts, which I think are economically implausible, but he can argue that, or whether he wants to be a mature politician who's trying to work with the government to improve what it's doing, to oppose some of what it's doing, but not most of it. And he's caught. And in this speech, he sort of tried to have it so much both ways. It's really deeply dismaying.
Johnny, do you think that's a bit harsh? It seems to me that actually he's trying to say two things, and that's always very difficult for a politician to do.
That's true. I think on an event like that, which is so broad brush, he could have got away with that, actually. You can just leave the detail to the sort of economics arguments, but the broad point that these cuts are too much, they're too fast, too deep, etc. I think that you can make that point, even if there's a slight sleight of hand over which exact cuts you'd make. The problem was, I think, with those comparisons, it reminded me a little bit of the Rory Bremner take on John Major. He once did John Major delivering the I Have a Dream speech, in which his John Major said, you know, I have a dream, I've been to the mountaintop, I've parked my car, I've paid and displayed, you know, the banality of it in comparison. And that, and you know, the cuts is a big cause, but once you start comparing it to Martin Luther King and apartheid, you make it seem small and you make the government relax, thinking actually this, they're not laying a glove.
That's a really interesting point there, Jackie, because I remember you many months ago, I mean, long before he was a clear contender for the leadership, saying the thing about Ed Miliband is that he does human. He does do human, but does he do leadership as well, do you think?
Well, I think he's a way to go on that. I think Ed is second to none. I've seen him do lots of meetings in rooms, in halls, and I think he's extremely good at engaging with the audience, getting a laugh, getting people on side, getting them to feel he's a warm character. I think what he can't do so well is the big set piece things. I think he's not very good at his party conference speech, for example, was not very good. He's not that good yet in the Commons, although I think he's improving at Prime Minister's Questions, and certainly at that kind of rally. I think what he lacks in a way is statesmanship and stature, and I think that's what he's trying to build. It doesn't come naturally. He's got to get a bit older apart from anything else.
He has time to do that as long as his party allows him. I think the statesmanship can come. The thing that I find disconcerting about that speech and the general Ed Miliband approach is the sense that everybody they meet agrees with them. So he believes, speaking, you know, I come for ordinary people, people of all classes. Well, there's some truth to that, but it isn't everybody in Britain. And the danger of oppositions that feel very righteous and very hostile to the government is they never meet anybody else. They become convinced the whole country agrees with them. They don't need to do very much to win people over.
I think Ed Miliband meets a lot of people in his own party that don't agree.
Well, he does, but they tend not to be agreeing with the government on cuts. They tend want him to go even further into the sort of Antonin Deva
party. I agree with your point about states. I just want to come in on this thing about statesmanship, because I think part of the problem he has is that the grammar of at least recent British politics, it doesn't include speaking at big rallies. That's not part of the profile of a statesman. So somebody said that they can't think.
It almost undermines that.
It does. I mean, somebody said they cannot think of a Labour leader who addressed a mass rally since Michael Foot addressing CND. Now, not a comparison Ed Miliband would enjoy. It'd be interesting to see if there are other examples. But there's something about the grammar of the mass rally which says to the TV audience watching, certainly opposition, but maybe kind of fringe opposition. And that's why the violent scenes didn't help at all. It doesn't fit the image, the optics, as they would now say, of a future prime minister. And so if he had asked himself, Ed Miliband, the question that I'm convinced David Cameron asks every single morning, which is, what would Blair do? Blair wouldn't be seen dead at an event like that, nor would Gordon Brown. And so he was immediately undermining, if he's trying, and I think Jackie's right about that move towards statesmanship, this isn't part of that.
But he has a sense of an insurgent, and he's an insurgent in his own mind, I think, against elements of his own party, as Jackie mentioned. He feels trapped by Labour traditions of the Blairite element and of some of what was around Brown. And so he wants to look like the young guy with a plan who's trying to get out from this old politics and break through with the people. Unfortunately, not everybody agrees with him, and he's got to lead people. He can't just assume that because he meets a huge number of people on a rally, Britain is suddenly supporting his policies.
It is intensely difficult opposition territory, isn't it? I think one of the good points he made, and he's made it repeatedly, is that this government is taking Britain back to the 80s. And that the danger is that the Labour Party is being forced back to the 1980s as well. How, Jackie, do you think he can somehow hold together that all-important kind of middle ground coalition, or rebuild it at least?
Well, I think he has got to come out and say a little bit more on the economy in particular, with Ed Balls in tandem with him. And I think part of the trouble is he is being painted as a deficit denier, which obviously is not going to work. And as Julian said, he doesn't oppose all the cuts, but perhaps he has got to be a little bit clearer about what he does and doesn't oppose, because at the moment we're in this rather unhappy position where people say, oh, so you oppose everything, and he says, no, but won't really tell us what he does.
I mean, he came up in an interview with BBC this week with the sort of example of road construction, of which I wasn't aware there was very much anyway planned. The government has cut what little was planned.
But he did say on policing.
Not a very quick last thought, John.
What he did say on policing, didn't he? I think they're doing 20%, we would have done 12%. And I think you could persuade people that in that middle is cutting into the bone. And you could keep making that the sort of argument. But I agree, it would have much greater political clarity if he did go down the full Ed Balls route and just say, we're not going to do anything until the economy is growing. I think people would get that. And if the economy tanked, he'd be vindicated.
Contentious
argument. We have to leave it there for now. Plenty more on our website at guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, earlier this week, Michael Gove embarked on what The Guardian described as another policy U-turn as he announced a more generous than expected replacement for the Education Maintenance Allowance. That's that incentive for less well-off teenagers who stay on at school after 16.
And today I propose to increase the amount of support that we give the most vulnerable. 12,000 students, those in care, care leavers, and those receiving income support, including the severely disabled, should in future all receive an annual bursary of £1,200 if they stay on in education. More every year than they ever received under EMA. I also propose that those most in need who are currently in receipt of EMA be protected. All young people who began courses in 2009-10 and who are told that they should receive EMA will still receive their weekly payments. And young people who started courses in the 2010-11 academic year and received the maximum weekly payment of £30 per week should now receive weekly payments of at least £20 until the end of the next academic year.
Now, whatever the merits of his change of mind, there's a bit of a pattern emerging here. There was the school building fiasco, the funding of school sport, where he reversed his earlier decision, another trip round the policy roundabout when he abandoned plans to get rid of a free book scheme for children. Julian, Andy Burnham described him as a journalist trying to be a minister. Now, I see there's nothing wrong with a journalist trying to be a minister, obviously, but yeah. do you think that's a fair criticism?
I think he has a journalist's awareness of the news in a way that some ministers don't. I think, to defend Gove, he's led the government on many of the areas he's trying to do. He was the person who went out there first with cuts. He then hit lots of trouble. They weren't properly announced. So he's taken a lot of flack as the sort of vanguard, a bit like the Arts Council cuts we've just had the other day. They're not the biggest element of cuts the government's going to be announcing, but we had them early, so we pay attention to them, and of course we should. So Gove took a hit early. He would argue that in the year since the Building Schools for the Future programme disaster, in the way the cuts were announced, I think not in the substance of the cuts, he's pushed on academies. He's gone from 200 academies to 460 in operation. There was early reports, the government's academy programme stalled. It isn't anymore. One in 10 secondary schools in Britain is now an academy. So he feels that in policy terms, he's making headway. In presentational terms, if you do things, you do get into trouble. On the EMA, that was a fault of everybody. And a lot of the welfare cuts the government's made, some of them at least, were misunderstood by the Treasury at the time they were made. There was a lack of understanding of either how politically sensitive they were or indeed how economically useful they were. What was odd about the EMA change was that it wasn't announced in the budget. It seems to be something that was bashed around Whitehall and suddenly spat out of the machine in the last few days. So there's some curious background to that.
The trouble with all these initiatives that he's had to go back on school sports and books and the like is he just came out with them far too quickly. I think trying to make a headline, trying to get publicity, trying to be one of the bright young boys of the cabinet. And he was at first. Oh, Michael Gove, people said he's a good chap.
Well,
but I think, he's now been caught by his own petard, he's been too quick to grab a headline. And he's come out with things without thinking it through, and now he's being found out.
Except, I think on the substance of what he's doing, he has not changed. These are small elements.
Well, and Johnny, he's clearly and really possibly dangerously at odds with his own department on this.
Does seem to be, and there does seem to be people who are ready to undermine him. You saw that in the summer with the Building Schools for the Future. You had the feeling that somebody there was leaking very unhelpfully to him. The thought that comes to my mind, and you partly touched on it with Andy Burnham's rebuke that he's a journalist trying to be a politician, Michael Gove does make me think there's something, and there is, quirky about our system, where somebody can go in with zero executive experience of running anything and suddenly running the entire school system. I mean, it's not just him, it's just the nature of our system. You're in opposition for a long time. He's just somebody who I think if he had been a junior minister, a schools minister, say, for a year or a couple of years, would have learned something about how you've got to check and double check the list that's handed to you with Building Schools of the Future, and would have avoided some of those things with, for example, the books and the school sport programmes. Instead, he's plunged in an incredibly high profile role with really, and we say this from the inside, he's got as much experience as we have, and we know that's not very much. We couldn't run a railway.
We couldn't do much better, let's face it.
Or a welk stool, and there, exactly, we couldn't. And I think that's partly why he does get a harsh ride, because people are looking at him thinking he's no better than us.
Johnny, you've already referred to the Blair shadow over this government. And are we not kind of getting a kind of reworking of 97 to 2001, which, Blair so notoriously said, I didn't try hard enough, I didn't do enough, and this government's determined not to make that.
Totally right. They're completely overcorrecting. They're obsessed by the idea that Blair, and I think they're right on this analytically, that Blair wasted that first term. He didn't know what he wanted to do. This lot prepared in advance. I think, as I understand it, they had Francis Maud and Oliver Letwin working basically on governance. happening for 6 months before the election. They wanted to hit the ground running. And Gove, and I think Jackie's right that to think that he wanted to be seen as somebody who gets out ahead of the pack, that he's bright and fast and sets an example. And so they went out there and just did it a bit too quick. He didn't see all around the corners. And I think a 2 or 3 years' experience under his belt might have prevented
it. But I would argue that you're being distracted by media rows. You know, on building schools for future, he hasn't U-turned. I mean, that the policy he announced was also correct. The scheme was unaffordable. It was not building the right kind of schools.
The point is, he said to one school, you're going to be okay, then he had to say, you're not okay, then you're okay.
Indeed, it is not easy to take money away from
judicial
people.
Reviews
there are judicial reviews. It is not easy. I'm not saying this has been a perfect scheme. But in the end, what he persisted with at the start of the year was an Academies Act that's passed. Academies are appearing. Free schools, they're beginning to happen. Building schools for future, that's been changed. The core of his policy is happening and it's intact. The presentational elements of it are certainly in trouble, and that may in the end bring him down. But we're being the journalists here and looking at him as journalists and saying what's good and what's bad. We're not looking at it as ministers.
That's only true that we're not looking at it as ministers.
Julian, on this point that, you know, what he's doing, he's getting the skeleton of his policy through, however difficult some of the presentation matters are. I wonder if he is really. I mean, what's happened to all this rhetoric about localism? Surely in this, and actually arguably in the health service as well, we're actually going to end up with even more centralism.
Well, that's the danger, that by giving things away, you feel you have to control them to stop them going wrong. And Johnny's point, I think, was very well made, that, you know, this minister comes in with no experience and runs the education service. Gove's response would be, well, that's why we're trying to change things. You know, you can't have any minister, however experienced, 2 years as schools minister doesn't suddenly make you brilliant at it. Certainly not with the NHS either. So that breaking things up is this government's maybe naive hope. Breaking things up, letting go, produces trouble. And so the common thread across what the government is trying to do is the sense of letting go. The reality is always going to be different because people in power feel they want to be running things, and there's that endless tension. So we will laugh at Gove and say, this isn't right, you know, you've been caught on a U-turn on this, you've been found out to have the wrong evidence on that. He would say, in the end, in academies, is the thing he's put his great effort into, and that was an element of the Blair government too.
But I think there's a more serious criticism. There's a more serious criticism, I think, of his main policy. I take your point that we should be looking at his main policy rather than all these little flibbity gibbets around the side. But I mean, I think with the academies and all the free schools, fine, they all seem to be going very well. I think the main problem with it is, what is he doing about the schools in those much poorer areas where they haven't got lots of well-motivated parents and businesses wanting to come in? I mean, I worry he's not doing enough still for the much poorer areas, and he's going to create an apartheid.
Well, I agree with that. And just one thing that he would say, and the Lib Dems particularly would say in response, is the pupil premium. I'm not certain that is going to be the full answer, but that is the thing they would...
I'm not sure that's going to be enough.
But there is a policy on that. It isn't an area that they claim to have nothing.
Much more, of course, on the website, educationguardian.co.uk. Now, what do Arthur Balfour, the Earl of Wilmington, yes, the Earl of Wilmington, Ted Heath and Pitt the Younger have in common?
They're not married. Ted Heath was the helpful one. I wouldn't have...
You're such a genius, Johnny.
I needed Ted Heath.
You'll start off at 10.
I was thinking of giving a different answer, but I won't on
well.
It.
Ed Miliband's name won't be on that list because it was revealed this week he's going to marry his longtime partner, Justine Thornton, this May. Johnny, do you think that's going to make him more electable?
It's not a totally trivial question, even though it's in the and finally slot on this programme. I don't know. I don't think it's a totally trivial question because I think he does have a family values problem, Ed Miliband. And it's started by the most obvious thing. The line that comes up again and again, isn't he the guy who shafted his own brother? I think the not being married wasn't central, but when that became coupled with, this thing about not getting a birth certificate for his first child, I didn't have time. It just seemed somehow people only have a few things by which they judge politicians. Sort of gut instinct. Is this person like me? I know that the voter is thinking, I know I probably would have wanted to sign my child's birth certificate, and I probably wouldn't have done that against my brother. And so into that mix, not being married wasn't helpful. I think on its own it would have been fine. I think the society has remarkably grown up about that, actually. But when it's mixed with everything else, I think it does make him seem out of step with where everyone else is.
Isn't the problem now, though? He looked as though he's been bounced into it.
Exactly. Is it a political decision? Isn't that worse?
Yeah, I think probably he should have just stayed with where he was and said, look, there's a huge number of people in this country who are either in single-parent families or live together unmarried, and that's modern Britain. Welcome to the real world, rather than suddenly go, oh, yes, at the age of 40, I feel very embarrassed about my unmarried state. So I think he's got the worst of both worlds in a way by going into it like that.
Do you think it was maybe a hugely political operation destined to, or designed, or in the hope that it could bring David back on board and he could be the best man. And
I don't know, call me uncynical. I was rather hoping he just wanted to get married, but maybe it is true that it's all political. I mean, the danger they've got is that people compare him to Cameron, and Cameron's remaining great strength with the voters is in focus groups. They all go, well, he's a nice family man, and it has really helped him. It didn't get him elected with a majority, but it got him quite close to it. And I think Labour does.
It was just that.
No, but it had a huge impact. The sense that Cameron was a caring father who'd use the NHS, who's.
Didn't help Gordon Brown much, though, did it? That.
Well, it didn't come across the same way with Gordon Brown.
I think if they played the leaving, the pictures of Gordon Brown leaving office.
Yeah.
The day he arrived, we would have had a completely different impression of him.
The funny thing is, you know, because your list of early prime ministers, Gordon Brown was presented to the voters as a Ted Heath-like figure, actually, partly because you never did see the children, and because, I mean, this thing about how political it is, he's also somebody who got married. Once established as a very senior politician, he was the Chancellor when he got married, and he'd been with Sarah Brown for quite a while. I think the difference here perhaps is that they have children. I'm prepared, in an uncynical way like Julian, to think that actually there are people who in their 40s who've been together a long time do decide it would be nice to get married anyway. I'm not wholly cynical about it, but I think how this thing looks because of the mix and swirl of other things, if he hadn't, in the popular perception, shafted his brother, and if he'd been there for the birth certificate of his kids, I think everyone would be warmly disposed to it. Instead, there's something not quite clicking.
What would be interesting is, would we these days consider that a man, say a gay man with no children, could be prime minister? Or would we think, oh no, that wouldn't work? You see, it's interesting. I think there's more of a sort of a culture against that now, because politicians do use their children all the time. And
Julian, what do you think? Do you think it would be acceptable?
Are we suggesting that we've had a gay man with no children as prime minister before? I think things are always possible when they happen, and then we adapt our view of what the public will accept. I mean, in Australia, we have an unmarried prime minister. Australia is quite traditional on these things, and the Labour Party in Australia has a strong Catholic tradition. Yes, but it's something that before Julia Gillard was chosen, people said that can't really work. It doesn't seem to have caused any harm at all. Australians go around talking about the first bloke. It is, however, hugely important for voters to have things that they can attach to politicians that they feel, well, that sums them up. And it doesn't have to be marriage.
I agree, and that's what
it's
may
just,
happen.
It just needs to be some sort of item. It could have been they've done something. I mean, for Ted Heath, it almost became he went sailing, or he did the orchestra. It doesn't have to be a certain, definite marriage, definite kids. You just want to have backstory. I mean, Gordon Brown sort of lacked backstory. He might have had this wonderfully happy family life.
He lacked plausible backstory.
But it sounded a bit odd when he said it.
Dry books.
And somehow Tony Blair, which his backstory might have been more complex, but it came across as a sort of jovial family man, and people like that.
It does mean we've got another leader's wife to focus on in that cruel and unrelenting way.
Yes, but I do think, thank goodness, Justine Thornton will not play that ghastly game that both Sam Cam played and Sarah Brown played and Sherry played. And I mean, I think she's so sensible and will just keep well out of it and not do these profiles and not get herself restyled and where she's any sense she will, but I think she will.
I agree with you, but I just fear that the pressure is always, and the Daily Mail start running photographs of her wearing ordinary clothes look at that.
An interesting test, though, because the press actually are not that interested in her, relatively speaking, not anything like the way they're in Sam Cam, and that's partly a judgment on him. They don't think he's about to be Prime Minister, and therefore they won't obsess about her. They didn't actually obsess about Sandra Howard or, is it Betsy Duncan Smith, because they never thought she was going to be anywhere near Downing Street anyway.
Unfortunately, we haven't got time to discuss what I really want to talk about, which was the motherhood and equality myth, but moving on, we can perhaps do that another day. There's just time to relive a remarkable moment in the chamber Minister's questions. As an increasingly irritated David Cameron at the dispatch box was being sledged from the Labour benches.
I completely understand the point the Honourable Lady makes, but particularly in Stoke, where the Potteries community... I wish the Shadow Chancellor would occasionally shut up and listen to the answer. I don't know whether...
Order! Other members can now follow the Prime Minister's advice to the Shadow Chancellor. We need a bit of order. The Prime Minister.
I may be alone in finding him the most annoying person in modern politics, but
So, anyone else got a really annoying politician they'd like to name?
Mine is just David Cameron, I'm afraid. I'm getting more and more irritated by his sort of smug flashman act at Prime Minister's question, so I think he takes his own label.
Julian.
I think Liam Fox, who is the implausible face of the Tory right.
I have to say, even when he's silent, Nick Clegg is doing something to me. When I see him hearing during any kind of Tory, I'm sort of empathising with Lib Dem voters around the country who just look at him and think, well, where's the person we voted for a year ago?
That nodding dog, isn't
nodding
it?
Nodding dog. And there's something, he also manages to have this expression. It's ridiculous because he's silent, but a slightly sort of worried, over-sincere expression on his face during parliamentary proceedings, which just sort of is beginning to get the flesh crawling.
It's an aspect of coalition politics which, despite all that was written about it in anticipation, no one's really considered. On that diplomatic note, it's time to say thank you very much to Jackie Ashley, Jonathan Friedland and Julian Glover, and the producer, Phil Maynard. I'm Anne Perkins. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.